As many garlands are made from a heap of flowers, so one who is a mortal born should perform many ethically skillful deeds. That's a verse from the Dhammapada, which is particularly associated with Visakha, one of the Buddha's disciples that I'm going to introduce you to perhaps today. You might already know her, but I didn't. So I'm going to read you, talk about her story. Partly because I've only just discovered it, and that's always quite nice to have something that's kind of a bit new to me. I've only come across this story this year. And I like it, and I found it helpful, so I'm going to talk to you about that as well. I think this story actually shows us a lot about Sangha. It shows us a lot about what it means to participate in Sangha in all our different ways. It shows us quite a lot about the early Sangha, the Sangha around the Buddha in his lifetime, and about, well, how it saw itself, really, how it's kind of talking about itself when it tells these stories hundreds of years after the Buddha's life, when these are written down. And it talks about generosity and really noticing generosity and how that affects us. So the early Sangha was actually made up of quite a diverse range of people. We think especially of the renunciants that really were kind of travelling with the Buddha. This is what the Buddha really encouraged anyone with the conditions and the aptitude for it to do, to really leave their home, leave all the comforts of domestic life and work, all the distractions of that, and live in the wilderness, homeless, wandering, confronting all the scary things, all the discomforts of that life, but really devoted to the life of meditation. These people are described as bhikkhus, which is often translated as monks. But they're really not like what we think of as monks, you know, with no habits and cloisters and monasteries. They're really kind of wild men and women living out in the wilderness. It's outside of normal society in lots of ways. But they do interact with normal society because they go to the villages for their food. They're begging for food. And that brings them into contact with people living a different life and lets them teach the Dharma to those people. Over time, they started to settle more and more. So the Buddha encouraged them to come together so they weren't completely individualistic or doing their own thing. They had various times, full moons where they came together, and the rainy season. During the 2 or 3 months of the monsoon, they'd hang out together and live communally, live as a community, a spiritual community, practicing together. Still depending on the villagers for their food, their alms. So they'd start to collect, and it seems that these times kind of got more and more extended and more formalised and suited some people more. So some people were living a more, what we think of as a monastic life, more settled life, or at least for part of the year. And that's what people, how people were living. And that all seems to have worked really well, and they were able to settle because, again, of their interaction with people who were living a domestic householder life, who had the means to do that. So they had particular wealthy patrons. They had people who gave them land where they could gather and then perhaps built buildings there or helped to support them in that way. So we know about some of these wealthy patrons. One that I know a lot more about is Anathapindika, who gave them land to be on, gave the Sangha, supported the Sangha. But another one, who I have just come across, is Visakha. So she is a very wealthy woman, and that's who I'm going to talk about today. She's part of a very wealthy elite. Her family and her husband's family are both part of this really wealthy elite. They're like bankers to kings. They're that kind of people, and they've got loads of treasure. There's another story about Visakha's jewels, which you have to be particularly strong to actually wear because it's such a whole kind of costume that it's really weighty. So they've obviously got plenty. But she is a disciple of the Buddha. I quite like this because it really shows that Buddhism isn't down on wealth in the way that some religions might be. It's okay to have lots of money. You can still follow the spiritual life. It's okay to live with all these jewels. What Buddhism would criticise is one's attachment to that wealth. If you're sort of miserly with it, then that becomes a problem, if you've got that sort of selfishness around it. And that's what we see Visakha hasn't got. She's very generous. She's also very, very beautiful. She's very calm. She's very graceful and very astute. And there's different stories about her that sort of bring out these qualities, which is why I feel that she's got those qualities. She's very mindful. And yeah, she's very astute. She's a businesswoman, really. She's also given the job of sort of managing the Sangha of the women's Sangha, sort of helping to settle disputes for them and things like that. So she's quite involved with supporting the homeless women in the Sangha. She was a devoted disciple of the Buddha since she was a child. She met the Buddha when she was apparently 7 or 8. And when she got married, she converted her in-laws to the Dharma by inviting the Buddha to speak, and they were convinced too. So yeah, there are different stories about her, but the one I'm going to tell you today, I'm going to read it in parts and sort of comment as we go. The occasion was this. The Blessed One had stayed as long as he chose at Benares, and he set out to wander by stages to Sarvati. When he eventually arrived there, he stayed in Jetta's Grove and not Pindika's Park. Then Visakha went down to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, she sat down at one side. After the Blessed One had instructed her with talk on the Dharma, she said, "Lord, let the Blessed One, together with the Sangha of Bhikkhus, accept tomorrow's meal from me." The Blessed One accepted in silence. I suppose he nodded. When she saw that the Blessed One had accepted, she rose from her seat, and after paying homage, she left, keeping him on her right. Now, on that occasion, towards the end of the night, a vast rain cloud was raining over all the continents. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. "Bhikkhus, just as it is raining down on Jetta's Grove, so it is raining down on all the four continents. Let it rain on your bodies, bhikkhus. This is the last time there will be a great rain cloud over all the four continents." "Even so, Lord," they replied, and they put aside their robes and let it rain on their bodies. This is them having a shower, isn't it? They're out there, they've got no homes. You know, this is their chance to get clean. They're having a nice shower in the rain. When Visakha had finished preparing good food of various kinds, she told the maid, "Go to the park and announce that it is time, thus. It is time, Lord. The meal is ready." "Yes, madam," she replied. So she's sending the maid to say, "It's dinner time, come on." The maid went to the park, and there she saw the bhikkhus with their robes put aside, letting it rain on their bodies. I think this is charmingly quirky. So I wanted to just read it as it is. She thought, "There are no bhikkhus in the park. There are naked ascetics letting it rain on their bodies. I can't see any monks that I'm used to. No one in a robe." So she went back and told Visakha this. Then it occurred to Visakha, who was wise, understanding, and sagacious. Surely it will be the lords who have put aside their robes and are letting it rain on their bodies. This silly girl thought they were not bhikkhus, but only naked ascetics letting it rain on their bodies. So she sent the maid back again with the message. By that time, the bhikkhus had cooled their limbs and refreshed their bodies, and they had taken their robes and gone into their dwellings. When the maid saw no bhikkhus, she thought, there are no bhikkhus, the park is empty. And she went back and told Visakha this. Then it occurred to Visakha, who was wise, understanding, and sagacious, surely the lords have cooled their limbs and refreshed their bodies, and they must have taken their robes and gone into their dwellings. This silly girl thought there were no bhikkhus in the park and that it was empty. So she sent the maid back again with the message. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, take your bowls and outer robes. It is time. The meal is ready. Even so, Lord, they replied. Then, it being morning, the Blessed One dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm. Actually, you can do it quite easily even without being strong. He vanished from Jetta's grove and appeared at Visakha's gate. Magic. Then the Blessed One sat down on the seat made ready, and likewise the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Visakha said, it is wonderful, Lord. It is marvellous how mighty and powerful the Perfect One is. For though there are floods knee-deep and waist-deep, not a single bhikkhu's feet or robes are wet. Magical things. And Visakha was happy and elated. Then with her own hands she served the Sangha of bhikkhus, headed by the Buddha, and satisfied them with good food of various kinds. So, nice picture. She's serving them herself, glad to be of service to the Sangha. When the Blessed One had eaten and no longer had the bowl in his hand, she sat down at one side and she said, Lord, I have 8 favours to ask of the Blessed One. Perfect ones have left favours behind, Visakha. So I think the Buddha is saying, we can't kind of grant magic. We can't grant wishes. Just being enlightened doesn't mean we can make things happen that you wish for. I think there was a whole tradition of superstition and magic going on around there, and it was quite common to actually pay holy people to do favours. So the Buddha's going, no, that's not our game, that's not the sort of practice we're engaged in. We've left favours behind. So Visakha replies, they are permissible, Lord, and blameless. So she's saying, this is okay, what I'm going to ask, just listen. And he says, then tell them, Visakha. So this is her request for favours, for boons, some translations have it. Lord, I should like to provide the Sangha with rain cloths for as long as I live. So this is special robes for the rainy season for the bhikkhus. And I should like similarly to provide food for visiting bhikkhus for as long as I live. Food for those setting out on a journey. Food for the sick. And food for sick attendants. Nursing, those nursing the sick. I should like similarly to provide medicine and a constant supply of gruel. And I should like similarly to provide bathing clothes for the Sangha of bhikkhunis. So this is the women followers of the Buddha. So she's asking for favours and she's actually offering gifts. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? So the Buddha thinks this is interesting too. So he replies, but Visakha, what benefits do you foresee when you ask the perfect one for these 8 favours? So he's saying, so, but what is in it for you? Why do you see these as favours? What benefit do you see? She says, Lord, so she's replying with the benefits. When I sent a maid to announce the time for the meal, she saw bhikkhus with their robes laid aside, letting it rain on their bodies. She thought that there were no bhikkhus, but only naked ascetics, letting it rain on their bodies, and she told me this. Nakedness, Lord, is improper. It is disgusting and repulsive. So that's a bit strongly put, but actually some of us were chatting in the Metro Cafe the other day about nudist beaches, and we agreed it wasn't actually very aesthetic. I can see the point. This is the benefit I foresee in wanting to provide rain clothes for the Sangha for as long as I live. So she wants to address this impropriety, and that will be a benefit. Again, Lord, a visiting bhikkhu who does not know the streets and alms resorts gets tired wandering for alms. After eating my food for a visitor, he will get to know the streets and alms resorts without getting tired wandering for alms. This is the benefit I foresee in wanting to provide food for visitors for as long as I live. So yeah, visitors need food. They don't know the ropes. They don't know the good houses to go and ask for food. They need a bit more help to get started when they arrive in a place. Again, Lord, when a bhikkhu is setting out on a journey, he may miss his caravan through having to seek food for himself, or he may arrive late at the place where he wants to stay, and he gets tired on the journey. After eating my food for those setting out on a journey, he will not suffer in that way. This is the benefit I foresee in wanting to provide food for those setting out on a journey for as long as I live. Again, Lord, when a sick bhikkhu does not get suitable food, his sickness can get worse and he can die. But when he eats my food for the sick, his sickness may not get worse and he may not die. This is the benefit I foresee in wanting to provide food for the sick in the Sangha for as long as I live. Again, Lord, when a sick nurse bhikkhu has to seek his own food, he may bring the sick bhikkhu his food after midday. So they had a rule that they were only to eat one meal a day before midday. There will be a breach of the rule not to eat after midday. But when he eats my food for sick nurses, he can bring the sick bhikkhu his food in time and there will be no breach of the rule. This is the benefit I foresee in wanting to provide food for sick nurses in the Sangha for as long as I live. So even apart from the rule, it's a bit inconvenient, isn't it, to be trying to look after somebody and having to go shopping. It's sort of nice if someone else did the shopping. Again, Lord, when a sick bhikkhu does not get suitable medicine, his sickness can get worse and he can die. But when he uses my medicine for the sick, his sickness may not get worse and he may not die. This is the benefit I foresee in wanting to provide medicine for the sick in the Sangha for as long as I live. Again, Lord, gruel was allowed at Anhakavinda by the Blessed One, who saw 10 advantages in it. So this must refer to some other episode. Seeing these 10 advantages, I want to provide a constant supply of gruel for the Sangha for as long as I live. So she wants to keep them just basically fed. Now, Lord, the bhikkhunis, the women disciples, are bathing naked at the same bathing place on the river Acharavati as the harlots use. The harlots make fun of the bhikkhunis, saying, "Why practice the holy life so young, ladies? Are not sensual desires to be enjoyed? You can live the holy life when you are old. Then you will have the benefit of both." When harlots make fun of them thus, the bhikkhunis are put out. "Nakedness for women is improper, Lord. It is disgusting and repulsive. This is the benefit I foresee in wanting to provide bathing clothes for the bhikkhunis for as long as I live. So she's done quite a lot of thinking about what the Sangha actually needs, what would really help and why. She's not offering them things that aren't going to help them in their spiritual life. She's offering them what they need to live as they're living. But the Buddha's still wondering why she thinks these are favours and what's in it for her. So he says, but Visakha, what benefits do you foresee for yourself in asking the Perfect One for the 8 favours? As to that, Lord, bhikkhus who have spent the rains in different parts will come to Sarvati to see the Blessed One. They will approach the Blessed One and question him thus. Lord, the bhikkhu named so-and-so has died. What is his destination? What is his rebirth? The Blessed One will tell how it is that one who has reached the fruit of stream entry, of once return, of non-return, of arahantship. So this happens quite a bit in the stories. Someone dies and then the disciples all go to the Buddha and say, so how far had he got in his spiritual life? Which stage had he got to? What kind of rebirth is he therefore going to have? Or is he not going to have one because he'd really got free? They seem the Buddha did eventually get tired of this before he died, but people want to know where people were getting to. So she's saying, people are going to come and ask you this question. So when they do that, she says, I shall approach them and ask, Lords, did that disciple ever come to Sarvati? If they answer that he did, because this is where she lives, I shall conclude that surely a rains cloth will have been used by that person, or visitor's food, or food for one going on a journey, or food for the sick, or food for a sick nurse, or medicine for the sick, or the constant gruel supply. So she's thinking, if someone's got on well in their spiritual life and they've passed through where I'm making these offerings, I'll have helped them in that quest. I'll have helped them in their growth and their development, their Dharma life in some way. So she feels like she'll have been part of someone else's growth. And when I remember it, I shall be glad. Well, you might, mightn't you? When I'm glad, I shall be happy. When my mind is happy, my body will be tranquil. When my body is tranquil, I shall feel pleasure. When I feel pleasure, my mind will become concentrated. So these are stages of the spiral path that a lot of you will be familiar with. We usually look at a path, there's different descriptions of it, that starts off with when you apply shraddha, faith, confidence in the Dharma to your experience of unsatisfactoriness, then there's the opportunity for these other mental events, these other things to arise: gladness, calming, tranquility, pleasure, joy. And then out of that, it allows you to really settle, really deepen your concentration. Out of that, you start to get insight into how things are. These factors all condition each other, and they're the beginning of this path to enlightenment. She says, that will maintain the spiritual faculties in being in me, and also the spiritual powers, and also the enlightenment factors. So these are other systems, other sets of spiritual qualities, faculties, powers. Most of them are all the same as each other. I looked them up last night and there's quite a lot of overlap in those groupings. But she's saying that her spiritual life will flower on the basis of her helping someone else's spiritual life. All these spiritual qualities are going to grow in her, and that's really her being helped on the path as well. This, Lord, is the benefit I foresee for myself in asking the 8 favours of the Perfect One. Good, good, Visakha. It is good that you have asked the Buddha the 8 favours foreseeing these benefits. I grant you the 8 favours. Then the Blessed One gave his blessing with these stanzas. Now, when a woman disciple of a sublime one, glad in virtue, gives both food and drink, and conquering avarice, bestows a gift, that leads to heaven, quells sorrow, and brings bliss. She gains the Dharma life, and by a path alike unblemished and immaculate. So loving merit in happiness and health, she long rejoices in the heavenly world. So that's our story. And I think it does just, yeah, it gives us this lovely picture of the kind of interactions between different people in the Sangha and how that works. And yeah, and this amazing generosity of this very, I mean, she's a very, very wealthy woman, but she's not kind of hoarding her wealth for herself. She's seeing that it's for the benefit of the Sangha. That's kind of, in a way, what her wealth is for. That's what she can do, and that is her spiritual life. It's often seen when we think about these different, you know, the householder, laymen, laywomen in the Buddha's life, they're often viewed as the kind of lesser disciples. They're not kind of doing the real thing, going out into the forest. And that all they can really do is gain merit, which is not like enlightenment, it's not like insight, it's just sort of, you know, like a nice feeling or something. They're gaining merit, but they're gaining goodness. But goodness is the start of the spiritual path. We begin with ethics, meditation, wisdom. They flower on the basis of each other. So it's not like merit is a separate thing that can only be limited. It's taking her onto the spiritual path through her giving to the others. And you get the impression that all these disciples of the Buddha were living quite harmoniously together. You get the impression they weren't saying to themselves or to each other, oh, she's not doing it properly, she's not left home and gone out, you know, into the world. And, you know, yeah. Oh, they're not really, you know, I don't know, they don't seem to be kind of separate. They're really a kind of symbiotic sangha, if you like. There's different people all interacting, helping each other. So there's this sense of this general, the sangha's practicing for the general spiritual uplift of all of them and of the whole population in some way, to whatever degree and whatever way they're each able to participate. I was really kind of taken by the lack of self-interest that when the Buddha said, so what's, you know, what's in it, why are these favours, she just didn't even start off with like, well, of course I'll be feeling really pleased if I do that. She started off with the way she'd thought about how it would help the Sangha. That was obviously what was really primary for her, was just helping the Sangha. That was her orientation. That was what she wanted to do with her life. But the story about her meeting with Buddha when she was 7 does say she gained stream entry at that point. So if she's been a stream entrant, she's been an advanced spiritual practitioner since she was a small child, then she obviously wouldn't have a lot of selfishness left by the time of this story. So it might not be quite like that for us. It might be important for us to really notice the gladness that can arise for us when we give, when we act ethically. So yeah, I just wanted to tell you about how I came across this story, really. So for quite a long while earlier this year, I'd got quite caught up in myself, in my sort of limitations and particular ways of viewing things. I was sort of realising I was coming towards the end of my term as chair and starting to wonder how to view that, and I was also having some difficulties in what I felt effective in that role. And it made me really aware of my negativity bias. We've all got this inbuilt negativity bias where we notice the difficult stuff in life. We needed it for evolutionary reasons. We needed to pay attention to the dangers of life or the things that we needed to learn from in order to survive. So we've all got that kind of current that we need to counter. So I was really getting caught in feeling like I was doing things wrong, I wasn't good enough, I was failing in different ways, and those kind of stories about myself were quite prominent. And nothing anyone said could counter it. I would hear, so if anyone sort of pointed out to me what was going well, I'd feel like they weren't hearing what I was saying in my kind of unease about something. I'd feel that wasn't really heard. If people pointed out how well I'd done at something, I'd think, yes, but there's something else here that isn't going so well that they're leaving out of the picture. They're not quite getting it. If people pointed out that I had here a wonderful opportunity to free myself from all these views I'd got stuck in, a wonderful opportunity for practice and transformation, I'd feel like they were really seeing how much I'd got something wrong with me that needed changing, and that I'd got to transform, and actually I was still failing because I wasn't managing to do it quick enough or enough somehow. Whenever anyone sort of said, oh yeah, but you could really, I was like, but I can't, I'm not. I was sort of feeling really caught, really stuck. So I worked with this in different ways over quite a number of months, and it was freeing up and it was easing in lots of ways. And I was on a 3-week solitary retreat, and I was basically quite content and quite happy, and this wasn't sort of troubling me anymore. But I noticed there was still a sort of flavour of it was around. When I was thinking, okay, I'm kind of coming to the end of my term as chair, how has it been? What's it been like over this time? What would come up straight away would be the things I'd found difficult, or the things that hadn't gone so well, or the things that we hadn't managed to do yet that I could see would be really great things to do as a Sangha. And I noticed this was going on and thought, okay, you need to counter that, Jwalamalini. Sit down, write a list of things, of the good things, the things that have been helpful for me, the ways I've changed, and the things that have gone well in the Sangha, the things you've achieved, the things that have been good. So I spent some time doing that, and that was kind of all right. It was like, it wasn't getting to the point somehow. It wasn't quite, it was almost like I'm still trying to convince myself of something by kind of balancing the, yes, but this was difficult, yes, but that was really good. And it's like, like I was kind of having a bit of an argument with myself in a way. Wasn't quite doing it. And then I remembered a conversation I'd had on the European Chairs Assembly a few weeks earlier, and I was talking to the chair of another Buddhist centre, who said to me, I think you need to reflect on your generosity. And he told me about this story. He didn't tell me the story, and I didn't have it to hand at the time. But I just remembered him saying, there's a really good sutra about that, about reflecting on generosity. I think that's what you need to do. So I thought, okay. Come on, Shwamali, reflect on your generosity. That would be the thing to do. And I thought, okay, what have you given to the Sangha in these years? And immediately, the gladness arose. And so something freed up completely. All this kind of battle with myself just fell away, straight away. I didn't get very far through writing my list of what I'd given. That's what I thought I'd do. I'd write one of these lists of what I'd given. And straight away, I just went, how many hundreds of meetings have I been in? How many dozens of classes have I led? How many hundreds of emails have I answered? How many spreadsheets have I looked at? It was just like on every level, there are so many. I've given so much. And that put me in touch with that spirit of generosity, that wish to give, rather than what the outcome was, rather than whether it had succeeded or failed, or whether I'd succeeded or failed, or whether it was good enough. That didn't matter because I had given. It didn't matter what happened as a result of me giving, in a way. It was just a very different emphasis. So I just found that just so effective. I can see the limitations to my giving. I could see things that I haven't been able to give, or ways that it would have been helpful if I'd been able to give differently or more, and that's because I am a conditioned human being. We've all got our particular bundles of stuff in ourselves, of things that we can do, things that we can't. And that was then fine. It was like, I've given what I can, and there are things that I can't, and that's okay. It's just somehow released it all into a different perspective. So I do really recommend this practice to you, of just really looking at what you give in your life as a whole and in the Sangha. And we all give in such different ways because we are different bundles of conditioned humanity. There are different things we're able to give. We give our presence. We've shown up today. We give our presence to each other. We listen to each other. We give our time and energy. We've probably all washed up mugs in that kitchen at some point. You know, you've all given something. We give money. We give our time, we give our energy. We support classes, we come along and help others. We talk to the people we meet. We talk to other people and help them connect and feel part of the Sangha. All of us have done some or all of these things. We've all helped. People come to Sangha Works and helped with the practical tasks. Yeah, people support on teams. People do all sorts of things to help. I'm sure each of you has done something to help the Sangha in this last year. You've all given to this Sangha. And it's just important to notice that and feel glad about it, because it is helping the spiritual uplift of the whole population in the way that was happening in the early Sangha. We're all participating. We're conditions for each other. We're part of what makes it possible for each other to practice. That's what Sangha is. It's that mutually co-created happening that allows us all to be on this path, actually, in all sorts of ways. At this time of year, we usually invite you to review what you're giving financially. We have a little campaign, or a big campaign, asking you to really look at your direct debit donation and see whether that matches what you want to give at the moment. So you might do that in the next few weeks, and you might think about whether you're giving in other ways as well, as much as you want to, or what suits who you are and what your particular means, your qualities, your skills, and your financial circumstances allow. What's right for you? You might find you're giving too much in some areas, or you're not giving in the best way for yourself. It's quite a thing to just really go out there, as who I am, with what I've got, what can I give? Vishakha was immensely wealthy. She could give in material, financial ways very easily, but most people in that Sangha couldn't. So she gave what she'd got to give, and other people give what they've got to give. But yeah, just important to rejoice first in what you do give before you start beating yourself up for not giving more. There are so many pitfalls, aren't there, in this? We start to compare ourselves. We say, oh, she's giving loads more money, but, you know, like, if all the Sangha in the Buddha's time were kind of fretting about not being able to give as much as Vishakha, who was really immensely wealthy, then they wouldn't have got very far. That wouldn't have helped them. That wouldn't have contributed to the general gladness and uplift of the whole community. And we do that, don't we? We sort of look at each other and the different things we give, and we worry that we're not doing as well as somebody else. But yeah, that's not very helpful. You need to really kind of stay true to yourself and what you can offer and what you feel moved to offer, and the ways in which you can sort of show your honouring and your value of the Sangha. Give in those ways. I think this is going to be especially important. It's always important. It's what provides the lifeblood of the Sangha. It's what creates Sangha. It's what keeps the Sangha vibrant and alive, that we all contribute in the ways we each can and really appreciate that in ourselves and in each other. I think it's going to be particularly important over the next few years, because I am, I hope, going to be handing over to somebody else as chair in the next year or so. We don't know yet who that will be and in what ways he or she will be able to give to the Sangha. But we do know they'll be new at being chair of Bristol Buddhist Centre. And it always takes a couple of years at least for someone to find their feet in that. They're going to need a really supportive Sangha. They're going to need things to be running well and everyone to be willing to give in their ways to make it all continue to flow, make it everything continue to happen. So I think it's really important. We're going to be looking more and more at how we can involve more people in some of the different aspects of running this centre, how people can give to that. But yeah, it's just important that we all keep really alive to the ways that we give over this transition time that's going to be coming up. You're all what makes it happen, what makes it all possible, everything we do together. You are this heap of flowers that the Dhammapada speaks about. There's three different translations of this verse I've got here. This one came particularly from a story about Visakha. As from a collection of flowers, many a garland can be made by an expert florist, so also much good can be done with wealth, out of faith, and generosity. So we're a collection of flowers, different qualities, different skills, different amounts of wealth, different amounts of energy, different amounts of time. We can do much out of faith and generosity. Another translation puts it, like garlands woven from a heap of flowers, fashion from your life as many good deeds. I like that. There's that sense of you and your life being part of something, creating something. Fashion from your life many good deeds as you could garlands from a huge heap of different flowers. As many garlands are made from a heap of flowers, so one who is a mortal born should perform many ethically skillful deeds.